Fire rescue, EMS, law enforcement. These are the three components of public safety, and those who answer the call are the first responders. Welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force with your host, Steve Green. Five Alarm Task Force presents some of the best instructors, leaders, and mentors in public safety today to educate, elucidate, and entertain. No topic is out of bounds, and every opinion has value. Five Alarm Task Force is brought to you by Five Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission. First responders helping each other. And our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, your best bet for fire service tick training. The Firehouse Tribune, where you can expand your horizons in emergency services and learn to work hard, stay safe, and live inspired. LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes. And our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Thin Red Line Decon Products, making decontamination as simple as possible for you with decon wipes, shampoo, body wash, and more. Haas Alert, creator of the safety cloud for our roads. Fry Guy Levers and Nestor Bars, the amazing new hand tools for the fire service. Silver Arrow Coaching and Consulting, unlock your potential from burnout to brilliance. Crackle Magazine, serving the International Fire Service. EFT Corporation, 40 plus years of innovation in donation and payment processing solutions. Health KPI, teaching you how to track the right data to stay at the top of your game. The Firefighter Cancer Foundation, fighting to extinguish firefighter cancer since 2004. The Firefighter Cancer Support Network. The Albemarle Sweet Shop, the North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. Remember, our ultimate goal is for you to be safe and return home after every call. So insert those earphones or turn up those speakers. The Five Alarm Task Force is being dispatched right now.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force. I'm your host, Steve Green. Happy to be here with you. Happy to have you here with us. My guest today, who will join us in just a few moments, will be David Wicklansky. David is a captain at a New Jersey city, and he is also one of the lead people for the state of New Jersey to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. So we're going to talk today with David about new programs that have been developed by the NFFF, and a couple other issues that we often see with behavioral health difficulties. So he'll be here in just a few moments. Now, if you listen to our podcast on the podcast platforms, on our website, or watch the video, and you enjoy it, well, you can listen to other of our videos and our audio podcasts. All you have to do is go to our website, and when you see, come down to the website, and on the top menu, just select from the horizontal menu across the top, select podcast. And that will take you to our entire library of our show for all the years we've been doing it, 8.5 years we have. Also, if you want to watch the videos or previously recorded videos, all you have to do is go to YouTube and look for our channel, the numeral 5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org, and you'll be able to listen or watch our video episodes or our audio episodes and catch up with that. We also want to give a shout out to our good friends on Facebook. You folks are amazing. I don't get to get there all that often, unfortunately, but when I do, there are so many comments there, positive comments, likes, etc. You really are one, as a group, one of our great stalwarts to help promote and enjoy listening or watching our podcast. That means a great deal to us. Now, we mentioned earlier that you listen to the audio versions, many of you, on a podcast platform. And those podcast platforms like to give you the opportunity to rate the podcast. Now, it might not be every podcast recording, but it might be in general. Needless to say, those platforms use an algorithm as to what kind of reviews that podcaster has. 3 stars, 4 stars, maybe 4 stars or 5 stars. That's a great sign to them. Or you write some positive comments, maybe 2 sentences, and that placates them as well. However, we need to ask you to please, even if you're a longtime listener, please go to the platform you listen to us on most of the time. And if they allow you to leave a review of some kind, whether it's stars or sentences, please do. Please do, because it's so important in this algorithm that if your name does not show up, maybe the top 10, you have no idea where it's going to be. And, you know, we're blessed with having listeners in up to 42 countries has been our best number. And we want to make sure that we're bringing you the information, the guests that you're interested to. And that's why we always say, if you're interested in being a guest or referring a guest to us, all you have to do is drop us an email to dalmatprod, D as in Delta, A Apple, L Lincoln, M Michael, A Apple, T Tango, P Peter, R Romeo, O Oscar, D Delta, at outlook.com. And we want to see those. We want to see, and we'll go do our best to capture that person you want and get them either on the video or audio, maybe both. And that makes this podcast even better with every guest that we have on. And I'm happy to say that coming up in the next week or so, we'll be rejoined with our good friend, I was Assistant Chief Jacob Johnson, but it might be higher than that. Maybe it's Deputy Chief Jacob Johnson, and he'll be on next week as well. So watch for that video to drop next weekend. And that's it. That's our business for this morning. So we're going to take a quick break. As you know, there'll be a couple of commercials and PSAs for us. And then we'll be back with our guest, David McClancy, right after these words. As always, please stay tuned. New technology for the fire service seems to appear almost every day. And that technology demands a learning curve, especially if we're talking about thermal imaging cameras. That's where Insight Fire Training LLC is your best bet. With an excellent reputation across the U.S., Insight Fire Training will meet all your TIC training needs. Their curriculum is peer-reviewed and has been used internationally. Their instructors are Level 1 Thermography Certified, and they have taught in 33 states and 4 countries. Their courses run from introductory to training the trainers. Courses are available online, for the classroom, classroom hybrid, and even live fire. Insight Training LLC is proficient in over 40 thermal imaging cameras, so you feel confident they will know your make and model. Best of all, programs are customized to your specific needs, and their cadre of fire service veterans are vetted craftsmen of Project Kill the Flashover. They are so proficient that they have trained TIC manufacturers on how to best use and sell their own product. That's Insight Fire Training LLC. Look them up on InsightTrainingLLC.com. Your best bet for TIC training. Would you like to meet up with Andy and the team from Insight Training? Well, here's part of their upcoming schedule for this month. March 7th through 9th, FITA is proud to partner with Insight Fire Training to host 3 offerings of Introduction to Tactical Thermal Imaging Max Firebox Live Fire Training Course. This classroom hybrid training consists of a 2.5-hour classroom session followed by a 1.5-hour live fire demonstration with a Max Firebox where those concepts are brought to life before the firefighter's eyes. The afternoon session would consist of a 2.5-hour classroom session followed by a 1.5-hour Palmer Dollhouse live fire demonstration. This class keeps the student engaged, provides hands-on time with thermal imaging cameras, and the class provides additional resources for the students in the form of a student manual in PDF format, along with access to a shared drive folder with a large amount of thermal imaging resources. This class is free, but each offering is limited to 40 attendees. On March 7th, FITA in Baton Rouge, 6868 Nicholson Drive, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, 70820, Building 5, Classroom 5A. Site contact is Dustin Kleinpeter. You can reach him at dustin.kleinpeter, K-L-E-I-N as in Nancy, Peter and P as in Paul, E-Echo, T-Tango, E-Echo, R-Romeo, at la.gov. On March 8th, Lafayette Parish Public Safety Building, 1825 West Willow Street, Scott, Louisiana, 70583, Classroom 3. The site contact is Lieutenant Karen Matthews. You can reach her at karenmatthews at lafayettesheriff.com. And March 9th, Historic Ruston Fire Station, 200 East Mississippi Avenue in Ruston, Louisiana, 71270. The main classroom, the site contact, Rusty Edwards, and rusty.edwards at la.gov. To register, just visit FETA, F-E-T-A, .la.gov/registration. Again, that's feta.la.gov/registration. Coming up March 12th to the 14th, Matthews Fire and EMS Max Firebox Thermal Imaging Training. Insight training instructor Thomas Anderson will be providing 3 individual 8-hour sessions of tactical thermal imaging training, which will include a classroom presentation, followed by 2 live fire demonstrations with a Max Firebox and a Palmer Dollhouse. These courses will be delivered at Matthews Fire Department on March 12th, 13th, and 14th from 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. each day. Your contact for more details is Chris Rayner at this email address. C is in Charlie, R Romeo, A Apple, N Nancy, E Echo, R Romeo. So it should be Craner at Matthews, MATTHEWSNC.gov. Again, that's Craner at MatthewsNC.gov. Then coming up on March 15th, Insight founder and owner Andy Starnes will be providing the keynote lecture, The Ultimate House Fire, Yours, at the inaugural Key City Fire Conference in Baltimore, Maryland, on Friday, March 15th, from 0800 to 1100 hours. This program focuses on highlighting the behavioral health concerns of first responders and family struggles. It explains the issues first responders face, statistical data, and many personal testimonies are shared. It is a program designed to awaken the heart and save firefighter lives, marriages, and families. The course outline is listed. The introduction, The Call Comes In, Part 1, Defining the Problem, Real Statistics on Real-Life Problems. A, Anxiety and Depression. B, Stress. C, PTSD. D, Alcohol Abuse. E, Substance Abuse. Part 2, Defining the Problem, continued. F is in Foxtrot, Financial Problems. G is in Golf, Firefighter Suicide. H is in Hotel, Marriage, Conflict, and Divorce. And Part 3, Saving Our Families, the Greatest Rescue. A, Solutions to Problems. B, The Great Hypocrisy, the Great Redemption. C, Fighting the Fires of Our Lives. D, Balance and Overcommitment. And E, The Courage to Commit, We Close with a Challenge. Visit https://www.keycityfireconference.org. Any proceeds raised from the Ultimate House Fire Program are donated to firefighter first responder-based charities. And finally, at the end of the month on March 30th, Insight Training founder Andy Starnes will be providing an 8-hour classroom hybrid training consisting of the following for Central Crossing Fire Protection District in Missouri on March 30th. It includes a 3-hour classroom lecture, 1 hour, Max Firebox live fire demonstration. 2.5 hour, classroom lecture. And a 1 hour, Palmer Dollhouse live fire demonstration. This event will be held at Central Crossing Fire Protection District, 23463 State Highway 39, Shell Knob. That's Shell, S-H-E-L-L, second word knob, like on the doorknob, K-N-O-B, Missouri, at 65747. For registration information, contact Kyle Moore, Battalion Chief, Central Crossing Fire Department, at area code 417-858-3560. Remember, please be sure to check their website, insighttrainingllc.com, or their Facebook page for registration and additional details. Insight Fire Training LLC, your best bet for fire service tick training. The Firehouse Tribune has expanded, now bringing you podcasts, presentations, and training blogs. The Firehouse Tribune is an innovative way for emergency services professionals to interact, share ideas, learn, and train. We are inspired by those who came before us and built the path for us to share knowledge and experience with the rest of the emergency services world, where life experiences and training come together. Check out our podcasts, Station Talk, and the 5-Tool Firefighter Podcast. Want us to speak at your department or event? Reach out to us to set up workshops at your firehouse or virtual event on topics including the 5-Tool Firefighter, 5 Key Attributes of the Well-Rounded Firefighter, and 6 Tips to Guide the New Fire Officer. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn, and be sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel. For more info, please visit www.firehousetribune.com or email us at fhtribunepodcast@gmail.com. The new Firehouse Tribune Services, where we live by one motto, not just in emergency services, but in life. Excellence is a habit, not a goal. We're firefighters. We're law enforcement. But like everyone else, we have our aches and pains, sometimes from the job and sometimes not. We realize there are risks with this job. However, sometimes something is wrong with us and we don't know it. Now what do? Well, LifeScan Wellness Centers are dedicated to saving America's heroes. For most fire and police organizations, LifeScan Wellness Centers will send one of their mobile teams to assess every member of your department with complete and complex physical exams and blood work. Using state-of-the-art medical equipment, LifeScan staff members provide a multi-procedural exam, including cardiac stress tests, basic lab results, and ultrasound exams. LifeScan wellness exams have saved the lives of dozens of firefighters and police officers across the country. They have found tumors, aortic bulges, lung problems, and more, many of which were asymptomatic. However, early detection allowed most of these colleagues to have their personal medical professionals mitigate the health issue that otherwise might have led to a darker time. For more information, please visit their website at lifescanwellness.com. Remember, LifeScan Wellness Centers, saving the lives of America's heroes. Hello and welcome to another episode of Five Alarm Task Force. I'm your host, Steve Green. Happy to be here with you and happy to have you here with us. And I am so happy today and so proud that my guest is someone I met 7 years ago. We just thought about that. We met in 2017 at the Great Florida Fire School. And he was on early on in the history of the show. And it's been tough to get him back because this man has his hands full. And I'm going to tell you about him. His name is David Wicklansky. And I got to say that when I first met David, it was the second day of the conference. We were sitting down for breakfast. And I just said to him before we started recording that I enjoyed that conversation with David, with Ryan Gallick, John Dixon, Battalion Chief John Dixon, and retired Battalion Chief John Hayowick. It was one of the most positive, strengthening discussions in the fire service that I've ever had. And I knew that this group of people would have a lot of effect on me and help, and just welcoming me as a non-firefighter anymore, because I was disabled in 85, was just sweet. And that's all at the hands of our good friend, Joe DeVito, over from Fort Myers Beach Fire District. And thank goodness all of them have remained friends over the years. Dave Oklansky is an engine company captain for an urban fire department in New Jersey. He has over 20 years in emergency services. David is a speaker and writer, with most of his presentations on behavioral health, in addition to suicide terrorism. His mission is to end the stigma associated with mental health and to connect responders with the available resources to not only survive, but thrive in their careers. He has contributed articles to Fire Engineering, Firehouse Magazine, Firehouse Tribune, Firefighting in Canada. His first book, Suicide Bombers, Understanding Suicide Terrorism from a Cultural and Mimetic Perspective, is available online, and he is currently working on authoring his next book. David has an MA in Behavioral Sciences, Human Behavior, and Organizational Psychology from Keene University. He has been an adjunct professor at Keene University for the past 17 years. You wouldn't know it because he's only 25 years old, but hey, he's very successful. applies himself. David holds certifications as a fire instructor too, EMT instructor, and New Jersey certified emergency manager. He is a behavioral health specialist for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, working on projects such as Taking Care of Our Own course and the Uniform Peer Support Program. He was recently hired as a program manager for the Vulnerability Assessment Program, VAP, an online risk assessment tool. David, it is great to welcome you back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back. Like you said, it's been forever and a day, and I apologize for not getting back sooner.
That's, well.
But yeah, I just felt really old when you said I've been at Keene 17 years. I was like, I know I wrote the bio, but man, 17 years?
Yeah.
But no, well, it's.
That's what I kind of joke with other of the firefighters, that I've been out longer than they've been in. When
COVID
was
just kind of minds.
We have one of our fire stations right down a quarter mile from our house, and they know I'm a former firefighter. I fly both flags every day, and they had to take me to the hospital back when I first got sick in 2020. And I said to the guy in the back, I said, "Hey, do you guys still have to fire contact control to start an IV?" He says, "How long have you been out, Steve?" I said, "Since 85. He goes, "That's about when we didn't have to contact control anymore to start IVs and do a lot of the stuff that you had to do in your age." And I said, "Yeah, I mean, we couldn't do any of it without contacting control, both in North Carolina and upstate New York." But it showed me the reason why. And I've always been, I guess I've always counted you and Ryan and John and John, some of the greatest mentors I ever had altogether in my 8 years. Just how we talked that morning at breakfast, how you guys kind of like shepherded me around a little bit to make sure I was enjoying it. And I remember on Tuesday of that week, Joe came up to me in the lobby and he put his arm around me, whispered in my ear, "You feel like a firefighter again?" I said, "Yeah, kind of." He goes, "That's the reason why I wanted you to come here. I didn't need you to take pictures. I wanted you to be here. And I wanted you to feel like you were doing something here." And that made such an impression on me that I knew I had to try to get all of you guys back on this show at some point already. Been in the first season. We're just finishing up by the time of the fire school. But I've been able to get John Dixon, John Haywick several times. I haven't been able to get Ryan, and it's great to have you back. Hard to believe in 8 years is only your second time, but I treasure every moment I get to learn with you. I just learned from the email you sent me yesterday. You taught me even more in that email, through the written word. So it means a great deal to me. And I think that the topics we're going to discuss today are going to be incredibly important for our viewers and listeners, especially those who are firefighters. Male or female doesn't make any difference. Volunteer, career, part pay, WUI, makes no difference either. Because what we're going to talk about today covers all of us in the fire service. And it even bleeds over to our brothers and sisters in the other two branches of public safety, our brothers and sisters in law enforcement, and our brothers and sisters in EMS. Because, listen, and I've, as you know, I've been, those of you who are regular viewers and listeners of the show, I've kept the Behavioral Health Initiative a key part of this program this season, especially. And David is the relative expert in these matters. And we're going to talk about a couple of the key programs and also the work he's helping to do for the NFFF, because that's our last way to make special for our brothers and sisters who made the ultimate sacrifice. So, David, tell us a little about what you've been doing, what you're busy with, and then we'll get on to the key topics for this morning.
Might be easier to discuss what I'm not busy with. we actually just came off of one heck of a month. We have been so busy with the Taking Care of Our Own program, which is phenomenal. So Taking Care of Our Own is a line of duty death preparation class. And it's one of those topics that no one ever wants to discuss, right? Because nobody ever thinks it's going to happen to them until it does.
Right.
And then they're scrambling to try and figure out, how do we honor the fallen? How do we take care of the family? How do we handle the benefit side of things? And we have a program through the foundation that allows for that education. And more importantly, that program is grant funded. And that's probably the hardest thing for people to understand is, yes, we will bring this program to you for free. I think the requirements to host it is you provide the space, you arrange for lunch, which might be, hey, I need to give you guys an hour to go out to lunch, or we can bring in sandwiches. And I think you're responsible for printing the student manuals. And that's it. We pay for the instructors, we pay for the flights, the hotels, the whole nine, just to bring this education to you. Last year we did, I think our boss said 17 courses throughout the entirety of 2023, and we trained somewhere around 350 firefighters.
Wow.
This year, since January 1st, we've just finished our 14th class, and we've trained over 525. And I mean, we are on pace for an absolute record-setting year. We were already there, and I think we're going to shatter all of our previously existing records. It just goes to show the amount of folks out there that are identifying, like, hey, you know what? This is serious, and we need to get this education. And again, it's a hard topic. It's a heavy topic. It weighs heavily on your heart. It's delivered by a fire chief who has had at least one line of duty death. The two chiefs that we work with is Chief Scott Burnett out of Asheville, North Carolina. Chief Burnett had a line of duty death, Captain Jeff Bowen, in a medical office building. It was an arson fire, and he's also had several that were cancer and occupationally linked. We also have Chief Ron Blackwell. He retired as the chief of Wichita, Kansas. He had a cardiac-related line of duty death while he was at Wichita. He had an off-duty firefighter death, active duty firefighter death, coming back from training. And he also had a near miss or a significant injury. The experience that the two of them bring to it is absolutely incredible from a chief's perspective. And it's not just the watered down of like, here is a policy and a procedure. It's here is the life that we had to live. Here is what we had to go through. Here is the good and the bad, because we don't tend to sugarcoat anything in that program, because it's not going to benefit anyone if we sugarcoat it.
Right.
The next two people that are involved in it, or we used to call them survivors. The new politically correct term is fire hero family members. You'll hear me go back and forth because I've been with the program 6 years now and I'm still trying to figure out the terminology. We have Gladys Falkenham. Her husband, Mark, was killed in a building fire in Baltimore County. It was actually one of the, I'll say, first heavily documented flow path related fires. The ATF actually did an amazing course detailing what happened at that fire and explaining the flow path and what transpired. On the other side, we have Joe Wojcik. He's a retired LA County fire captain. He spent 37 years in the fire service, and his son, Kevin, was one of the Granite Mountain hotshots. So he could explain things from both the perspective of the fire service, as well as from being a family member. So he gives us both the father as well as the captain perspective.
David, let me
And
just,
then
David, let me interject, excuse me, one second here. One of the things that our team did at 5-Alarm Task Force Corp in the midst of the pandemic of 2020, we created our nonprofit, 5-Alarm Task Force Corp, that has one purpose. Our purpose is to raise money so that we can provide fairly rapid cash to a family of a brother or sister with an LODI, or God forbid, an LODD. And yes, there are GoFundMes, programs for these people, but we vet the story. And that's between myself, retired Battalion Chief Andy Starnes, and training instructor Nick Higgins. We vet, one of us vets the story, then the information comes back to me. We send out a check to who the person that we were are guided to make sure the family receives it. So with David talking about these two issues right here, it is important for you to help us. We don't ask you for lots of money. We'd love it, but we're not going to ask you for that. We like $5 and $10 donations. And all you have to do to make that donation is very easy. You can use a credit card, an ACH, a debit card, anything like that. Go to our website, please, at www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. And all you have to do is scroll down just a little bit on the homepage, click on that beautiful picture of that federal Q2B siren, and our donation page will come up. And all you have to do is fill it in. All we ask is that what tells you, ask you to choose where you want the money to go to, please say to the foundation, because every penny that goes in the foundation goes out to a firefighting family. Every penny goes out to a firefighting family, whether they're fire hero survivors, as David just used the term, which I do like better. I think it's more respectful, and it means shows that we do share this with every firefighter in the country, this concept. And we will thank you very much for your donation, and know that the money that you donate, no matter its value, will go to a firefighter who suffered a traumatic injury, or to surviving members of the family, if it is a line of duty death. So again, we'll bring it up later in the show, but thank you for that, and we hope that you'll help David and I both out, because what we're doing is our version of helping those families, because we are a family. We may not always agree on every point, political, sociological, whatever, but we are a family. And we, therefore, we must stay together and help each other, because that's what families do. Thanks, David.
I'm totally in agreement with you, and that's one of the things that we discuss in the class is that immediate relief to families. And while we talk about public safety officer benefits or PSOB, there's a significant delay. It's a federal benefits program. There's going to be a delay in getting money to those families. So those immediate funds, whether they be 100 clubs or charitable organizations like yourself, or even the GoFundMes, which they take such a high percentage nowadays, it's not even funny. I want to say it's 8 or 10%, if I remember correctly.
Something like that.
And unfortunately, there's the scams that go on where somebody goes, "Oh, I'm raising money for the family," but it's not validated, and people like to just benefit off of the suffering of others.
Yeah.
So explain Joe, explain Gladys. All right, and then the last two. So any given class is going to have four of us are going to attend. Our boss, Ian Bennett, he is the Line of Duty Death Outreach Coordinator for the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. He oversees the TACU program. He oversees our Uniform Peer Support program, and he oversees our PSOB program. Arguably one of the busiest men that I know, and considering how busy my schedule is, that says a lot. So we will send him. We will send a fire chief. We will send a family or fire hero family member, and then one of the two behavioral health specialists, either myself or Dr. Angie Moreland from the Medical University of South Carolina. Angie is a whole lot smarter than me. She actually runs the Center for Mass Violence, I believe is the appropriate title for it, and also the Center for Firefighter Behavioral Health, which is doing some remarkable work at coming up with vetted, culturally competent clinicians for our firefighters so we don't have to send people out the door guessing. And all too often we hear the horror stories of, I found a psychologist, I finally got an appointment, which nowadays I'm hearing 6 to 9 months to be able to get an appointment with a psychologist or a psychiatrist, which to me is absolutely mind-blowing with the amount of time that it takes when somebody has the strength to say, hey, I need help and I need help now. And we go, oh, yeah, well, we'll schedule you for 6 months from now because that's how long it's taking. Not sure what the solution is yet. We're having a conversation the other day in one of our classes, and we can't quite figure out what the most appropriate answer is. But to be able to get those culturally competent clinicians connected with people that need their services the most, so we're not burning that 6 to 9 months sending them to somebody, they don't make that connection, then they have to find somebody new. Like most things, you need a good doctor, you need a good lawyer, you need a good mechanic. But if for whatever reason they're not working for you, find somebody else. Don't just give up on the process. We wouldn't just say that if I went to the first doctor and I didn't agree with them, okay, I'm just never going to go to a doctor again in my life. We need to be able to kind of steer people to those that understand it. Talking to one of the members of our peer support team, he works in New York. He is a plumber as a tradesman, and he's a volunteer fire chief. They had a line of duty death incident. He went to see a therapist and he told me that it took the first 2 1-hour sessions for the therapist to wrap their head around the fact that he has a full-time day job as a plumber and he is a volunteer at night. And he goes, Dave, I'm going to be honest with you. After that, I was just like, therapy is not for me. I was like, no, therapy is totally for you. It's just that therapist is not. So it took us some, I'll say, horse trading, if you will. But we got them connected with somebody who is actually active duty FDNY and also a therapist. So I don't think you're going to have to explain anything about the job at that point. So it's very beneficial in that case. So a lot about our program. This is going to definitely sound like an infomercial, but it's two of the programs that I'm working on, and it's something that I'm very passionate about because we're getting out there and we're getting to directly meet fire hero family members, and we're dealing with people who have had line of duty deaths in their agencies, and just the emotional ramifications of it. Program starts out, we're handling the notification aspect of it and the pre-planning aspect. Now, we hope and we pray that you put together a plan for how you're going to handle a line of duty death, and that, like many other plans, it sits on a shelf forever and never gets used. That's the ultimate goal. I would love a year where we don't have to honor anybody at Emmitsburg. I realize it's probably never going to happen, but this year, I want to say we're sitting at 221 that's being honored in May, which is astronomical numbers. COVID has a lot to do with that because of the COVID criteria. But that's still 221 people who are now no longer with their families. So we put this plan together. We discuss the planning process. We discuss what it's going to look like. We discuss the notification aspect of it, which unfortunately, in today's day and age of social media, you're probably not beating Twitter or Facebook or Instagram or any of these other things. I know I've been at home and I've gotten text messages going, hey, you have a big fire at work. And then the recall goes out for it. And literally, somebody was texting me before I was even notified about it. That's just the interconnected nature of our lives. But I'm going to editorialize a bit because what bothers me the most is when people post incomplete or incorrect information. If I could expect one thing from everybody, and it's going to sound like a really odd request, in the event that you are notified of a significant injury or line of duty death, please give it 24 hours. Let the family be notified. Let the agency handle that notification. Most recently, Loudoun, Virginia, they had a gas explosion. We were out on a training class. Our phones all light up, start scrolling through social media. And I actually read somebody go, oh, I heard it was, this person from this engine company. And I'm staring dumbfounded at my phone going, oh my God, Like, is that how you would want your family to find out? And it just doesn't make any sense to me. I guess people want to be that person who scoops it and they want to be the first to know, but that doesn't work. Like, let's be respectful to the family. 24 hours is usually plenty of time, but they don't need to be getting text messages or Facebook posts, you know, thinking about our brothers and sisters at XYZ agency or prayers for this person and the inevitable, oh, what happened? And then somebody else is like, well, direct message me. We'll talk about it. You don't need to be doing that. You need to let the agency do what they need to do. So the notification process, we have a benefits discussion because there's a lot of benefits out there that people aren't aware of other than just PSOB. PSOB has expanded a lot in the since 1976 when it incepted. It was only trauma. We added hometown heroes, so we added heart attacks, strokes, large vessel occlusions, vascular ruptures. We've also added now during the period of COVID, that was Protecting America's First Responders Act. In 2022, we added the Public Safety Officer Support Act. I'm not sure how I feel about this. So PSOSA covers suicides with limited, with a limited scope as of right now. Like most things, legislators write legislation. They push it down. It's PSOB's job to implement it. We don't really have all the correct requirements right now because we're not there yet. Having come out in November of 2022, we figured by about 2025, we'll have it flushed out well enough that we'll have a pretty good handle on it. That was written specifically with the purposes of the January 6th incident at the Capitol. And there's been a couple that involved the Pulse nightclub shootings and officers who have ended their lives or died by suicide as a result of the direct and proximate cause was their incidents. Where I'm torn on that is not taking care of the family. Where I'm torn on that is paying out the benefit post-death when we could use that money to keep people on this earth and get them the help and treatment that they need. And it'd be nice if we can have some of that funding to be able to do just that. If people didn't have to worry about using their own insurance to go to see a therapist, if they don't have insurance, where they simply wouldn't have to worry about it at all. And there are some programs out there that can afford to cover it. Next Rung is one that comes to my mind where they pay for a lot of therapy for firefighters and first responders, but they can't do it all themselves. I'm not trying to raise money for them or anything of that nature. It's the first one that comes to my mind. The current PSOB benefit is $437,500, $503, something like that. It goes up with the consumer price index every October. It tends to go up, I think only once it's ever gone down. That's a tremendous amount of money that could be pulled into resources to protect our first responders.
Right.
So while I understand the nature behind the legislation, I'm torn on the application side of things. So
I can
I don't know.
understand that. I really do, especially having worked for as the administrator and triage director of a large family practice for 12 years. A little more, I guess, a little more 12 years. And now when I need more medical care, seeing a different side. When we had our office, large, busy office, but everybody got taken care of. And my job was to streamline the processes to not have to wait so long, get them in with good timing with the doctor, et cetera, and the follow-ups. I found over the last 3 years that I've been sick that medical care today, for the most part, is being swallowed up by corporate America. And not necessarily by doctors of corporate America, but by business people who want to own a medical practice. And that's where we wind up with a lot of these problems of, I just had to, a couple of weeks ago, I made an appointment with a sleep specialist. And the first, so this was still in, early, the first week of the month of February. And the first one they had was third week of April. So I said, I understand. I said, but do you have a standby list if there are cancellations? She goes, yes. And I said, would you please put me on that list? Because I don't know that I can wait until then. Example is the last up until yesterday was Monday. So till Sunday night, my average sleep for the previous week averaged about 4 hours a night. And I didn't have gongs or special red lights turning on to wake me up. I just couldn't sleep anymore. And finally, I did a little, couple of other things that my nurse from the electronic company that I have two electronic leads in to help reduce pain at my major injury, which is L4, L5. And then with Raynaud's syndrome, they have another lead they put in to help connect it to the tibial nerve to help reduce that discomfort from that. Because with Raynaud's, you often, as I do, I feel like every step I take is on thumbtacks pointing up, and my feet are encased in two blocks of ice at the same time. So what I found, though, is at least my pain management doctor, is he doesn't want anything to do with the money or anything like that. He says, my job is to take care of my patients, and that's what I'm going to do. And nobody's going to sway me from my first duty, which is to my patients. And I've been with him 14 years. He's never pushed me out of the office, out of the procedure room early. He always wants to make sure I'm okay. We've become dear friends over the years. I remember after my third appointment, he stopped me leaving out of the hall, and he says, oh, where's your phone? I said, it's in my pocket. Did I leave it in the room? He goes, no, I want to give you my number. I said, excuse me? He says, I want to give you my number if you need me. I said, you don't have to do that. That's not, you can't do that with a patient. He says, no, I'm not doing it with all my patients, but I'm doing it with you. And probably since then, maybe I've had to text him maybe 12 times in all that time.
Okay.
So, you know, he knows that I won't abuse it. And he always tells me, I just saw him Friday again. He says, look, if you have any concerns, it's not right working for you, just call me and we're going to take care of it for you, Steve. That's what the medical practice was that I grew up with and that I knew. Even when I was in EMS, that's the kind of practice that we worked with, practices and the doctors at the hospital. They were there to take care of people first, and business was second to that. And there was that's what the business office was for. They want to be doctors to their patients. Today, that's being eroded by corporate greed. You know, with my weight, for my thing, you just mentioned about the getting to see a therapist could be 3-4 months down the road. We can't have somebody going in a traumatic, what I call traumatic disorder, because they can't get to a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thank goodness, even my hematologist oncologist, I don't need the oncology part. We're just working on the hematology part. But, you know, he says the same thing to me. I don't care about the money side of it. I'm here for you, the people. That's why I did what I did, emigrated from India, worked my way through medical school, got into Miami, started doing my fellowships down in Miami Beach. And so I could do the very best I can for my doctors. He says, most of these corporate grabbers aren't even physicians. They're just business people. They want to make more money. And I said, has it gotten that bad? Because that's my view of it. Because it's even worse than you've been thinking. And you know what? You think about the growing elderly side, and I'm well there. I just turned 72 yesterday. Two medical disorders, both autoimmune disorders. One's well under control, but this Raynaud's is not, because there are not a lot of people who specialize in it. I was lucky to find the specialty to handle it is rheumatology. When I look for rheumatologists, I happen to remember the name of the one that we used to refer to from our office. And I got an appointment with them, and they done it within 3 weeks of my call. And I introduced myself to him. He says, yeah, I know, you used to work with Randy. I said, yeah. He goes, you used to send us a lot of people. He said, yeah, we did. He goes, why? I said, because Randy and I both felt that you were the best person to help our patients with rheumatological problems. He says, "Well, I appreciate that, Stephen. I'm going to take good care of you." Well, that first appointment, nearly 3 hours he spent with me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's unheard of.
Now, he'd have to send me to this test in the office and that test in the office, and we'd come back and review it again. But I was there almost 4 hours altogether to do this. And I said to him, I said, "I can't thank you enough." He goes, "Well, I haven't done anything yet." He goes, "Oh, yes, you have." He goes, "What did I do?" I said, "You kind of resolved my belief in the good belief of how medicine should work." Yeah, he goes, "I hear that a lot from my patients today." I said, "I know, but I'm glad you're here and I'm glad you're taking care of me." So it is a dastardly situation in the American medical fields today. Not all practices, this is happening too, but I've been now connected to four that were all bought out. My doctors that I've spoken about it, where we close the door and put up white noise, is that they don't like it. They're not able to be the doctors they want to be. They're puppets. And order more tests, order more tests, order more tests. We make more money that way if they order more tests. He doesn't like it. He just does not like it. He says, "That's not why I went to medical school, why I specialized in gastro care." He says, "It's just not where I want to be. And I don't know how much longer I'm going to tolerate it, because my patients aren't getting the real help that they need, because I don't have enough time to do it, because I got to turn that patient over 15 minutes. So wait a second, you got to turn every gastro patient over, no matter what it is? So yeah, about 15, 20 minutes on the outset. This is not the America we grew up with, where, yes, it was always big business from 1600s on. It was business, but not at the cost of patient care and patient needs. And what you've just experienced, triples, quadruples my situation, because my situation is not an urgent medical care, but it's a medical situation with an autoimmune disorder. But if we don't have the doctors who feel confident in what they can do to treat their patients and can do the tests that are necessary, not requested by the business owners, they would be a lot happier. Because to a T, in these last 3 years, all the doctors that I've either found because I knew them when I worked at our practice, or I found them because if they were referred to me by somebody else, all of them said they love being a doctor. They just don't like being in a business practice.
Yeah. I don't think anybody goes into medicine fully understanding what it's going to entail, though.
Right.
And I get why it exists that way. But it's nice when you hear those good stories of the clinicians that actually still care and want to take care of their patients, despite the overwhelming amount of adversity that they have to deal with that we never see. And I don't think my doctor once has ever complained about the bureaucracy of it. I could see it on his face, but he won't openly complain about it because that's just not the type of person he is.
Right.
Yeah, I'm still not sure what the answer is, but I'm sure if I figured that out, I could make a whole lot more money and I could be a consultant and travel the world and tell people how to fix medicine. But that's definitely, I'd be bored to tears in about 30 seconds. Right. That's definitely not me.
I understand that. So let's, is there more left on the, at first?
Yeah, a couple more things on it. So after we go through pre-planning and notification, both our chief and our fire hero family member tell their stories in their own words. It's one of the things that we noticed when we had all of the COVID restrictions was we never wanted our program to go into an online or a web-based format. You just don't get that same engagement. You don't get the same message. And that's a good thing. We recently completed one actually in New Jersey for the state FMBA conference. The reviews were phenomenal. And we actually just had a conversation with them yesterday about trying to deliver that training to all of their districts. They have three districts, a north, a central, and a south, because their leadership has gone, this is so vitally important for our members that we want to get this back here, which is great, and I truly appreciate that.
I said to
Once we get to
Nick, I said to Nick a few weeks ago when our late brother Marky Hudson lost his life in Piscataway. I said, "You got you and David there. You guys will make sure everything goes right the way it's supposed to go, and help your department through it." Well, for Nick, it was his department, but knowing that you're one of the lead people for NFFF in Jersey, I knew that, no line of duty death is easy for us, but I knew he would have the help and his mother would have the help. So well deserved.
Yeah, that was a rough one. The funeral was definitely not easy at all. One of the, so we have the Everyone Goes Home advocacy program, and then we also have our, they're called last team. So it's local assistance state teams. We now have a last team in 48 states. We just added Utah. So they are our specialists for line of duty death. They will assist the family and the agency with the benefits paperwork. They could assist with behavioral health. They could assist with funeral planning and preparation. It's actually Chief Greg Collier runs New Jersey's last team, and he is not only a wealth of knowledge, but he is the human network. If there's ever somebody that I need to get in touch with that I don't know yet, I just call him and I go, "Hey, I need to get in touch with this person." He's like, "Give me 30 seconds," and he can link you with whoever you need to be linked to. And that resource is amazing because they're all volunteers. They give of their time to go out and assist these families in their worst days ever. And that's one of the programs that, again, the foundation has a tremendous amount of programs. I don't even think I fully grasp all of the programs that we have. And I've been on staff for the last 6 years. I was an advocate prior to and consistent with that, concurrent with that, I guess is the more appropriate word. But man, the amount of things that they can do. And what really impressed me the most is any donations that go to the NFFF is strictly for families and family programming. Our program is grant funded by the Department of Justice. Our Uniform Peer Support Program is grant funded by the Department of Justice. Anyone who makes a donation, large or small, that money will never go towards our programs. It will only go towards family programs, which warms my heart because I don't ever want people thinking that, well, I donate to the NFFF and that just funds you guys going out and teaching programs. It doesn't. It goes towards our families and making sure that they are taken care of and their loved one is honored, which is truly amazing.
It is.
The
We
last.
donated at the end of 2023. We sent a check of $500 to the NFFF because,
That's fantastic.
other than just handling the ones that we help individually, the three of us felt it was imperative to support the organization that is truly at the forefront of what we're trying to help with. So why, we were a little more flush in our funding then. And we decided we're going to send a nice contribution to the NFFF. And we're just one of our proudest moments just to write that check.
They're definitely a wonderful organization to support. The last portion of the TAKU program is mine or Angie's, where we cover the behavioral health side of things. We currently have it broken down into two different tracks, if you will. We have the family side of things, so experiencing grief and traumatic loss and the new normal, if you will, and how long it usually takes. Most of the time we get questions of how long is it going to be until I feel normal again post loss. I was like, there's really no normal again. There's the new normal. And when you start to explain to people that it's going to be 1 to 2 years until they start to feel this gradual recovery, their eyes almost light up again because so often in society, we have people being told after 30 days, why are you still grieving? Because it's only been 30 days. Now, for people to say that they've never truly experienced loss or they haven't processed it very well. So that 1 to 2 years, you get through the anniversaries of both the death, the wedding anniversaries, the birthdays, the holidays, all the things that tear the scab right back off again and make that wound fresh. And then we start to see that gradual recovery. After we get through that, then we start talking about the fire service side of things and the behavioral health side and how we need to be looking out for our own and taking better care of them. Because all too often we see the signs, but we don't recognize them because we have information, but we don't have the right context for it. And that is where we have people that fall through the cracks. And that's the most disheartening thing I think I've ever seen, is people that we should have been able to help had we been able to process all of that information at the right time and had the right context for it. But I've been on the team 6 years now. It's been a whirlwind. I can't tell you half the places we've been. That's what the map behind me is actually for. It's all the places that I've either spoken at or done conferences for. So if you know anybody in that northern area, that Montana, North Dakota, Oregon, I need to get out there. So if anybody needs me to come out, please let me know. I want to fill out that map, hopefully, before I end my career. But I will provide, obviously, my contact info. You'll have it. Your followership can have it. If anybody's interested in hosting our class, I'll put you in touch with our boss. We love to do what we do. We love going out to places. We love making those connections. And we love getting people thinking about the fact that, God forbid this ever happens to you, that first 24 to 48 hours of how we address the family and how we meet their needs will dictate how well their healing goes. So if we do it properly and we execute it like the rock stars that we know we can be, it'll make their process that much easier.
I
I think that's
understand
about
that.
it.
Yeah, I understand that very well. I've officiated at probably well over 200 funerals since we moved back here in 92, 90. We moved back. And one of the things I do when I've been asked to officiate is I try to get to the family as quickly as possible, even if it's the same day, so I can sit with them and help them through their grief. Tell them that I don't talk about in my I don't do eulogies anymore. I stopped doing those over 20 years ago, and I do a celebration of life instead. We don't need to sit there and tell the person that Uncle Billy was sick for 3 years, and was just wasting away in the bed, and then he died. What does that accomplish? How does that relieve grief and comfort the family? Instead, when I sit with the family, I'm putting my notes together. I said, tell me what they liked. Tell me what they didn't like. Tell me what their funny jokes were. Tell me what jokes they liked, but nobody else liked them. And that's, I don't dwell on what happened the 3 weeks before they passed. I focus on their entire lifestyle, how the couple met in the first place. And the funny little stories that come out of that, things like that. And thank goodness, by making that switch, thanks to a good friend of mine, another rabbi, I've had people laughing crying tears of laughter, not woe and alas is me. And they're laughing and they're elbowing the person next to them saying, that was funny. Remember that when he did that? That is the absolute best way I found to help the families that I am. And I've done Jewish funerals, I've done non-Jewish funerals. But I 20, 20, 25 years ago, I changed that whole method, thanks to a friend of mine. And it's had the best. And I officially don't charge a fee. I said, if you're interested in gratuity, that's fine, but I don't charge fees for something like this. This is too personal to charge a fee for. I've had rabbis, I've spent 3 nights with a family in a row, was putting the notes together and stuff like that, where I've known rabbis who are on booking for the funeral home, and they come in, they look at the paper, they talk with them for 10 minutes, then they go in, do a quick eulogy, quick service, they're gone with their $500, $600 in hand. So to me, I said, I can't do this for money. This is who I am. I'm a man of faith. How do I not help people in their crux of doubting their faith? Because why did this happen? Something like that. So I don't, that's not something I can deal with in my celebration of life, but that's something that people watching this and listening to you can learn, that there are people who are still caring and loving and empathetic and sympathetic to your issues. You just have to try to find them, and don't stop until you do, because those people are the good people, and they do it out of the goodness of their hearts. And that, to me, has made my heart feel better. It's not a, absolutely. You know, listen, none of this is easy. None of this happy and glad stuff. This is all sadness and sorrow. Okay, we lose somebody. But if we don't remember them for the life they led, doing the best they could, especially members of our public safety teams, then we're not doing them justice. And I think the program you're talking about, this first program, I think is going to be very, very beneficial. And the more it spreads, the better it's going to be. And it's going to make its way throughout the fire service, that this is who we reach out to when, God forbid, if this happens to us, we're going to make it work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this is all about. Yeah.
We've also adopted your mindset with that, too. If we go somewhere and we know there has been a line of duty death, and we'll generally ask the class if they've had experience with it. If we're aware of it, we're going to an area where we are personally aware of it. Yeah, I could read the NIOSH report. I can read the statement of loss, but I want to know who that firefighter was. I want to know, were they the chef that's always in the kitchen? Were they the habitual ball that all they do is they make jokes all day long, but the shift goes by that much faster? Those are the things that I can't read about. Those are the things that I can get the firsthand information from their colleagues. And it actually makes it more real. It's not just a report on a sheet of paper or on a computer screen. You can actually make that connection of who that person really was in real life. And it also tends to allow them to talk about them. There's an old expression, I'm probably going to paraphrase it because I don't remember it specifically, but it's, a hero dies twice, once the date of their death, and once is the last time anyone speaks their name. So if we could sit here and constantly talk about our membership, they never truly die.
Very true. Very true. Well, folks, we're going to take a break here, and we'll be bringing David back right after the break to talk about another important program that he's working on with the NFFF. And I think if you're in the fire service and you're listening to or watching this episode of Five Alarm Task Force, there is a lot, not for you to learn, but to grasp and learn about, because we can only share so much time here, David's schedule, my schedule, but we both felt that this was an imperative that had to be discussed. And we're lucky with the size of our audiences and other countries as well who listen. This is going to apply for anybody in any fire department anywhere on this planet. Because we know there are fire departments all over the world. And some are way above others, and some are kind of low and small volunteer companies. But we have to remember, the day we take our oath and receive our badge is the day we say, I'm willing to lay down my life for my fellow person. And that's tough to be able to say that. And that's why we do. So if you're watching the video, you won't see anything change different. If you're watching the audio, if you're listening to the audio, you'll hear a couple of PSAs for the fire service. And then we'll be right back with our guest, David Wicklansky, as we talk about the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation and the programs for our firefighters in this country right now to help them and their loved ones understand what could be ahead in the tragic event that a line of duty death occurs, or even a serious line of duty injury. So we'll be right back with David Wicklansky right after these words. As always, please stay tuned. The tone sounds and the dispatcher announces, Stations 14 and 16, working residential structure. And that was all you needed to hear. You jump up from your chair, head to the engine, and climb into the jump seat. As the cue screams, you take stock of your PPE. Bunker pants, check. Turnout coat, check. Hood, check. Gloves, check. Escape line, check. SCBA strapped on, you're ready. Upon arrival, you jump off the apparatus, grab the loops of the Red Cross lay, and head for the open front door, where smoke is pouring out. You make sure your buddy is behind you. Crouch low and make your way inside, your trusty SCBA mask hanging on your tool belt. What? Stop everything! What the hell are you thinking? You see, it's a working room and contents fire, and the smoke is banking down almost to the floor. Who do you think you are, Superman? One breath of that crap and the smoke will damage you in some way, guaranteed. All the soot, carbon, carcinogens, and other outgassing materials will enter your body through the pores on your unprotected face. Don't be the domino, the first person down, that forces everyone else to change their tasks to take care of you. Always remember, face peace on. You have comrades depending on you and a family to go to. Face peace on.
Remember when you were a young boy or girl and someone bullied or teased you? Where do you most often turn? Like many of us, you turn to your family. If you're a first responder, you probably no longer worry about those childhood problems. But there are plenty more that can affect us. Lack of sleep, the tragedy and horror we often see, even life's everyday stumbling blocks, like family illness, money, job problems, and more. So where do you turn now? Your gut reaction might be to keep it to yourself and not tell anyone about the hell you're going through. However, that's not going to help you or anyone else. Instead, you could start with your second family, someone you work with at the firehouse, on the ambulance, or at the station. You spend a lot of time with them, and most of them understand many of the problems you're dealing with. Reach out to a coworker or an officer you trust, speak to clergy at your house of worship, or contact your CISM team. Don't keep it inside, gnawing away at you. That's not good for you or anyone around you. Know that there are people who stand ready to listen to you and help you without passing judgment. Remember, to carry out your oath to protect life and property, the first life you have to care for is your own. Brought to you by 5 Alarm Task Force, along with the Critical Incident Stress Management Team in your area, close by and confidential.
Are you one of those people who thinks it's okay to drive stoned? I mean, what's the worst that can happen? You end up driving below the speed limit? It's no big deal, right? Wrong. The truth is, your reaction times slow way down when you're high. You not only put yourself in danger, but everyone around you. Talk about a buzzkill. Stop kidding yourself. It's not okay to drive high. If you've been using marijuana in any form, do not get behind the wheel. If you feel different, you drive different. Drive high, get a DUI. Paid for by NHTSA.
Hello and welcome back to this episode of 5 Alarm Task Force and my guest, Captain David Wicklansky. And David is one of, other than being a very busy firefighter as an officer, he has dedicated his life since I met him, basically, to helping the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation in many ways, different capacities, but he's there. He's always there. And he also specializes in behavioral health. And as we know, starting just basically a year after the Firefighter Cancer Initiative, we listed the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative. And I've, in this season, our eighth season, I've really tried to put a stronger tone on it. And that's one of the reasons why I reached out to David, because he is astute. He knows what he speaks with his degrees and his classes that he's taken. And we wanted to touch on this, these other issues, plus other assets that the NFFF has for our firefighters. So, David, let's spend a little bit of time with the next program that we're going to talk about. And also, let's make sure we leave time to really address the issue of the Behavioral Health Initiative and why it is so important, more so today than ever before.
Certainly. So I want to take a couple minutes to address, it's, I don't want to say new to me program. I just took over as the program manager of what's called the Fire Service Vulnerability Assessment Program, or VAP. If you're not familiar with it, as many people are not, it is a risk-based or risk assessment tool that is online. A couple of things that I love most about it. So it incepted back in the early 2010s, I want to say 2011, 2012. U.S. Fire Administrator Ernie Mitchell had an idea about generating a risk assessment tool that would answer the question of what don't we know and how do we make it safer for our firefighters? So when we think about that question of we don't know what we don't know, it's easy to go, we're going to be okay. But once it comes brought to your attention, hey, you know what, maybe we need to look at different safety aspects. If you don't know where to direct your attention, you'll never be able to figure that out. My predecessor, Dr. Joanne Kelly, I give her a lot of credit. She did a phenomenal job with the program. She's recently turned it over. When I was given the opportunity to apply for it, it was one of those things that it allowed my data analysis nerd mind to just excel at. So I'll give you the brief rundown of it. It's a series of yes or no questions. There's a total of 7 assessments right now. It is 100% free, so any fire department in the nation can apply for it. We're only supposed to have 1 authorized representative per fire department, but you could have other contributing members. Originally, it was geared for fire chiefs, deputy chiefs, and assistant chiefs, but being realistic, and no disrespect intended to those individuals, they don't have the time to complete this. So it is probably going to get pushed down to a captain or a lieutenant or a firefighter assigned to health and safety. So I don't have a problem with approving any of those folks to be able to get into this. In addition to it being 100% free, it is 100% confidential. Your answers will only ever be known to you. So as the program manager, I had created a sample account just so I could play with it on the student side. And I cannot see from my manager account what my own answers are in my student account. So I like that from the risk liability perspective. I understand that a lot of agencies are concerned about whether or not they would be able to have their answers used against them. So how does the VAP work? The VAP works by you answering a series of yes or no questions. So one of those questions might be something as simple as, does your agency have a seatbelt use policy? If you were to answer yes, fantastic. We applaud you for that. We think everyone should have it. Obviously, we have a number of line of duty deaths every year that involve responding to and returning from calls. If you were to answer no for whatever reason, not a big deal. The program will provide you with resources that'll get you started. So it'll give you a sample program or sample policy. It'll give you a white paper on the use of seatbelts in the fire service. Everything that you answer no to gets assigned a risk, low, medium, and high. And from that, additional resources will be provided to you. I want to say we're at 1,800 and some odd resources currently between the 7 assessments that we have. So there's a tremendous amount of body of work out there. And one of the things that I'm looking to do in the next year or so is expand on that body of work with more recent resources. So the big VAP, as we call it, or the OG VAP, is 412 questions. It sounds terrifyingly long. It's really not. It takes about 20 minutes to actually get through if you have a good working knowledge of your policies. From there, we have the quick VAP, which is 100 questions. We have a company officer VAP, which was designed for company officers to complete. We have a cardiac. We have a cancer. We have a roadway safety. And of course, my personal favorite, we have a behavioral health. I'm kind of biased in the behavioral health. So a little story of how I got involved with the VAP was, a little more than 2 years ago, I get an email that goes, hey, would you be interested in working on this project? And I was like, I don't even know what this project is. I've never heard of the VAP before. I don't have any intimate knowledge of it. And they're like, we'll pass your information along. Dr. Kelly reaches out, goes, you were referred to me. Do you want to work on this? It's, you know, we're going to look for you to develop somewhere between 45 and 75 questions, 1 to 2 resources piece, just to be able to help people address the behavioral health concerns. And I went, wow, I could reach a much wider audience that doesn't involve a speaking circuit, that involves from the comfort of their own homes or from their offices being able to complete this and show their bosses or their commissioners or selectmen or whatever they, whoever they work under, that here is a risk assessment tool that we've identified some behavioral health risks and we want to put policies and practices into place. So I built the behavioral health tool and I went, this is incredible. Between that and the roadway safety and everything else that we currently have, we have a tremendous body of resources there. My goal, and again, funding dependent, we're pretty good on grant funding. I have a tremendous amount of support. Our director of fire programs, John Tippett, Chief Tippett, is amazing to work for. It's always, you know, take it and run with it. If you need something from me, let me know. But if not, he 100% supports us and he doesn't micromanage anything, which is just truly incredible. I would like to put together a wildland specific module because the wildland community is not like the structural community. Having come from only the structural community, I can't even imagine carrying a rake and having to walk in and try and beat out a fire with a rake. I mean, to me, that's just foreign. I'm sure a bunch of them look at us and go, why do you go inside burning buildings where it could fall on your head? But that's okay. And I'm not sure where else I want to go with it, but I know that's one of the first things that I want to do. We're making a couple of modifications to the program right now. You'll see it roll out probably in the next 45 or 60 days. I want people to be able to take this year over year so they can actually show the progress that they're making. So it's going to have a comparison sample so they can take the same assessment and see, you know, in 2024, we answered no to these following questions. And in 2025, we have a substantially less amount of questions that we answered no to because we put policies and procedures into place to reduce our line of duty deaths, to reduce our injuries, and to make the fire service as a whole safer. And that is truly an amazing thing to me.
It is.
We've gotten state support. Dr. Kelly worked with the state of Washington, and through their Department of Labor, they offer a financial incentive for the completion of this. I want to say it's 10% off of the workers' comp insurance that is provided by the state to fire departments if they complete the VAP, because they've now done a risk assessment. They've identified what their vulnerabilities are, and they can then correct it, which obviously reduces line of duty injuries, which then reduces workers' comp costs. And the state goes, we're going to take care of you. I just had a conversation with Greg Kirkham from the state of New Jersey about putting this out to all of our New Jersey fire departments. Just here it is. Use it. I'm a Jersey guy. If you need me to come to your firehouse and explain how to use it and sit down with you, sure. If I can't do it on Zoom, it's really not that far for me to get to anywhere in New Jersey anyway. I want people to use the tool because I see the value in the tool. And that's not just from the program manager perspective. That's from the perspective of a behaviorist, somebody who is very data driven. If you're going to try and argue for safer turnout gear or new SCBA or newer equipment, you need the data to be able to provide that. And if you have the data to provide that from this tool, it'll make that argument better. It allows you to work through your strategic plans, your five-year plans. It allows you to minimize the predictable line of duty deaths, the things that we know are hurting our firefighters, the cardiacs, the cancers, the behavioral health, the responding to roadway incidents, all of the different on-scene tasks. Currently, we have just under 1,600 participating departments across the nation. This also applies to Canada for any of your listeners that are in Canada. I can approve Canadian departments. So if you are interested, if you would like to go to firevap.org, firevap.org, top right-hand corner is create an account. Usually it takes me about 24 hours. I validate who you are. If you have a department email address, it makes my life so much easier. If you appear on the department's website, it makes my life easier. If there's an organizational chart, it's fantastic. If not, and I can't validate exactly who you are, you might just get an email from me going like, hey, I just need some additional resources. Not trying to put a stumbling block in the way, but there are organizations out there that are for-profit think tank type things that have tried to access the data set and use it for their own financial gain. This program is grant funded like everything else is. We're pushing it out for free. We don't want our work and our body of literature to be used by somebody else for profit. We want you to have access to it for free. We want you to be able to use it. We want you to better your department. We want you to take better care of your people as a result of it. So I couldn't be more happy to be part of this and to be able to push it. We're using it to cross-pollinate in all of our programs now. It's going back into our Taku program, the Everyone Goes Home program. Our new advocate, Dan Kistner, our lead coordinator, I think this is the exact title, is going to be able to push this out to all of our advocates across the states. So we have this valuable tool, and just now it's a matter of getting people to use it. So I'm so happy that I was able to actually discuss this with you and be able to push it out to your audience. Because prior to working on it, I didn't know it existed. I don't want to say that it was the best kept secret. It was never really a secret, but it's not also something that people go looking for. They don't wake up one day and
Sure.
go, I need a
Sure.
vulnerability assessment tool. I wonder where I can find one. I know in the state of Missouri, it's being incorporated into their Fire Officer 4 program because of that strategic goal and strategic vision component. So we have this tool. Please feel free, sign up for it. If you have questions, again, you'll have my contact information. Shoot me an email. I'll explain it. I'll jump on a web call with you. If you happen to live in Hawaii, I'll gladly come out and visit you, just to make sure this gets done properly, or in any of those states that are up there that are currently vacant that I don't already have, because I need to check those off my list. So I think that's the Cliff Notes version of the VAP without getting super into the
Right.
questions and the resources and everything else. But I don't want to, I'm not saying bore your audience, but I don't want to pull too much more time away from them because we've already
Good.
gone well over an hour so far. But
Okay, that's good.
any questions about that?
No, I think that part's really good. I think it was really well done. And I'm glad that you did share it today on the VAP. Because again, domestically in the US, in Canada, we have a lot of listeners, a lot of listeners. And several of them are fire leaders in their departments, so, or have been. So I think they're going to take this message because both of two of the people I'm thinking of right off the bat were. Are de have dealt with personally, and the some of the stigmas that occur in this job, and when we have these sorts of incidents and emergencies, and have they had to pay a cost to get themselves whole again, and they both have. And they're both flourishing, both recent book authors and the fire service. So I think that the VAP is a very simple way, for all intents and purposes, of getting these kind of the data you need to feed the machine, and that you guys can get better angles, maybe some that you're already familiar with. Maybe there's a new angle sometimes that you didn't know about, but boy, is it important. Turns out to be important anyway. And that's this program seems like it's built to make it a nice, simple program, very little cost to it at all for the people who want to enroll in it and take it. And they can be assured that their information will be kept private.
Zero cost, 100%
Exactly.
free, and confidential.
Exactly. Very good. Very good. All right, we're going to talk next in just a moment with David about the behavioral health initiative. And we'll be talking a little, probably a little bit more outside the lines on that as well in just a minute. So David, let's continue now with one of the topics that you and I both really agree on is the absolute unqualified need for the fire service to embrace the behavioral health initiative. We are seeing far too many of our brothers and sisters taking their own lives. They feel they have no place to turn to. Nobody will understand what they're thinking. The sad part is, they don't often give others a chance to try to reach out and help them. And so we need programs We need people like you who are dedicated to good mental health everywhere, but your focus with that magnifying glass is on the fire service, because we are so strongly connected to it. And we've both seen the costs that some American heroes pay just for doing their job.
Completely agreed. And it's unfortunate. When I first got into the fire service, obviously after you, I started in a generation of the suck it up mentality, where we didn't talk about mental health. We didn't address it at all.
Same thing. I had it in mine. First apartment in North Carolina. We had a really bad accident about 1 o'clock Sunday morning, Saturday night over Sunday morning. And I lived only less than a half mile from the fire station. And my buddy, this kid I met back then in 77, who's still my best friend today in 2024, he was sleeping in the bunk room that night. And I got there, and our caretaker, who's their job, we had three caretakers. They worked 24 on, 48 off to get the first apparatus out the door. So the chief is screaming that the car's on fire. The man's entrapped inside the car. It was one of the older Chevy trucks that had the gas cap right behind the driver's door. Remember those? So unfortunately, the gentleman had been drinking. He swerved, lost his thing. The truck turned over on its left side, knocked the cap right off, and then the fuel came out and was ignited. So the caretaker says, "Steve, get up in the front seat. Come on, go. We got to go. We can't wait for an officer. You're going to run it." I said, "Okay." So we go, and the chief is screaming on the radio, "Get me water. Get me water." And then he starts yelling, "Don't connect to the hydrant. We'll backlay it. Backlay it. Just get me the 750 gallons ASAP." And we worked at it. And when we first got there, we're pulling the line out, and you can hear the guy still alive screaming in the truck. Now, if that doesn't discombobulate you, I don't know what will. But you can't let it. That's the key. So we just took what we had to do seriously, got the water going, flowing, and with our last drops, we got the last flames out. The EMS supervisor came, the ops manager. He had the Hurst tool, because we didn't have Hurst tools in our departments. It was the ops director for the entire county EMS was the only one who had it. So we got it out there. We used it. We got him out. He lived in the, he was transferred to the burn site and lived for three days when he passed. What happened was, we got back to the barn and cleaned up the engine. And then I went into the locker room, and I puked. I was crying. I was just emotionally distraught from it. Hmm. But I had to go back out again to help finish with the truck, the apparatus, I mean, and wipe my eyes. And the driver, our caretaker, who was the driver that night, saw me coming out. He says, "Are you okay?" I said, "Not really." He goes, "Was it this call?" I said, "Yeah." He goes, "Oh, you have to suck it up." It was the first time I ever heard it. And yet today, in working with a therapist, the two greatest traumas I had, two of the three greatest traumas I had, one was that night with that fire. And now I forgot the other one, but it was an important one. And there was just no support. Not even the chief, not even the captain. It's just, hey, these things happen. We have to do the best we can with it. Now it's still listed as one of my traumas, my life's traumas.
I understand why people say that, because there was never any education. There was never any support. They simply didn't know any better. I think we're finally getting to the point in the fire service where we have understood that we're not robots. They might like to think we are, but we're not. We're human beings. We have human emotions. We have to address them. One of the analogies that I use most often, and pretty much any firefighter who's ever come through the ranks understands this. When you learn to mop a floor, you learn that the most effective way to mop a floor is to constantly wring out all the dirty water and have your clean water so you can actually run your mop over the floor and get up all the dirt. If we think about ourselves as grief mops, which is pretty much what our job title entails, is going and dealing with the grief of humanity at their worst possible moments and providing them with that level of service that they expect from us, we have to wring out our own mops. It's just a matter of how do we do that? That's where things get dicey. We now have peer support programs. The NFPA in 1500 addresses the need for peer support. We have the occupational exposure questionnaire. We have trauma screening forms. We have chaplaincy programs, which is invaluable. The agency that I'm with, we have eight different chaplains. We have everything from faith-based to non-denominational. So just pick your favorite and go talk to them. We have counselors that are embedded in certain departments, but I also understand that those that can afford the counselors to be embedded are generally larger agencies. FDNY has an entire counseling support unit. A small rural volunteer fire department isn't going to have access to the same level of resources, which is why it's so important to go back to that cultural competency and having clinicians available to them. But we're also starting to see that education component coming in. I know here in New Jersey, they added a 3-hour resiliency module to the Firefighter One curriculum. It's a good introduction to people coming into this field of it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to ask for help. And despite what you might hear in your firehouses, there's always somebody who is willing to listen to you. I also don't think that we do a very good job of explaining to people exactly what the fire service is about. I mean, I always thought growing up that the fire service was driving fast with red lights and sirens and rescuing cats out of trees. And that was this youthful idealism that I had growing up and coming into the fire service. And then all of a sudden, it smacks me in the face that we're dealing with extrications and technical rescues and burn victims, like you described. And it's like, wow, like this is really not the fun, like super cool job that I thought it was going to be. Don't get me wrong, it's still an amazing job. It's probably the
It
best
is.
career I've ever had in my life. I have less than 10 years to go before I retire, and I'm not sure that I'm ever going to want to leave, but I know I'll always be attached to the fire service somehow. I guess where I'm going with this is there is always somebody that is willing to listen to you. You just have to know where to look and be able to reach out to those people. It takes a tremendous amount of strength to say, hey, I need help with this, because we have this mindset that when we pull off our uniform shirt, that there's a giant Superman S on our chest and that we can handle everything that comes forward. That's not the way it is. And that's not the way it should ever be. Because when we take that mindset of suck it up, we take that trauma and we bury it deep. And then the next trauma goes on top of it. And then we get into, if you want to talk about gas physics, critical supersaturation, where we have so much going on that eventually we bubble over. And we're not bubbling over at the best time when we're by ourselves and we can do it. We're bubbling over when we're on a scene and we end up on YouTube screaming at a resident. We're bubbling over when we're at home and we're yelling at our family or our spouses. So then we end up with that additional workload that we have to work through. I'm a huge believer in therapy. I have a therapist of my own. It's helped me work through a lot of the things that maybe I can't process on my own, because you almost need to say things out loud, have somebody hear them and go, yeah, that's probably not going to work. Why don't we try this? Or why don't we try something else? And you go, damn it, why didn't I think about that? Because you can't be as introspective as we would like to be, and you can't solve all of your problems within your own head. So there are people out there that are willing to listen. There are crisis text lines. Obviously, the suicide hotline, thank God it's gone to 988. I could barely remember the old number. I think it was 1-800-257 something. But it was so long that even if you're trying to give it to somebody, they're not following it. Chunk the information, call 988. There was a recent article where I want to say their usage is up to over 1,000 calls a month, which is incredible. But those are people that are reaching out going, I need this assistance. When we look at the, unfortunately, the suicide rate in the United States is going up. We're at around 50,000 completed suicides a year. There's about a 25-to-1 attempt to completion ratio. So 1.2, 1.3 million attempts a year. And these are people that saw no other way out because they simply did not realize there were resources out there for them. We're
Yes,
seeing it in the person.
I want to bring up one thing. When I was mentioning my hematologist before, when I met him, I met him through another good friends of ours. My friend was being treated for lung cancer, and the doctor and I hit it off. And when I had my my first issue with him, I said, "By the way, do you know?" He goes, "Well, what do you know about the Firefighter Cancer Initiative?" He says, "I don't know what you're talking about." I said, "Well, it's based here in at U University UM's Sylvester Camp Comprehensive Cancer Center, and that team there takes care of the state of Florida with the cancer program." He says, "Really?" He says, "Can you tell me a little bit about it?" So I did, and he said, "I never even thought of asking new patients coming in if they had ever worked in the fire service before." He says, "Where can I get more information?" So I gave him the info, and he really took the ball and ran with it. And now every patient, new patient coming into the practice, either him or the other two doctors in there will ask, "Have you, are you, or have you ever been a firefighter?" Whether it's in Florida or anywhere else. And then now, of course, then right after that's so we had the cancer initiative, we had the behavioral health initiative, and then we find ourselves in a situation where how do we get this message out to our brothers and sisters that there are people who want to take care of us, protecting our health and well-being. And then we came up, came through with broader programs and stuff like that. So I had my PFAS tests done last summer. The doctor was not going to order them unless they were going to be paid for. He didn't, because some of these tests can be very expensive. I'm not going to burden you with, if I can get it covered, then I'm going to do them. And we did them. And other than the fact that we all have some PFAS in it now, all 7.2 billion people in the world have are contaminated with PFAS in one way or another. But the fact now we have a focus for it. So if you don't think that you somebody, a counselor that you're talking with, or some sort of help, if they're not getting the gist of your message, maybe as I had to do about the cancer initiative, you have to educate them so they can then educate themselves. And I think that my situation, I think, could apply really to anybody who's seeing a specialist, medical, behavioral health, whatever, and tell them where you're coming from. You're not just a guy on the third floor of a building wearing a shirt and narrow necktie every day, doing your 8 hours, then going home, and that's it. You got, we have, we in public safety, all three branches have major issues that we deal with based on our experiences. Just like anything else in life. I went on a great cruise. Oh, that was wonderful. I'd love to go on that again. Now the weather was crappy. I don't want to do that again. They'll throw it out, throw out the baby with the bathwater. But there are good people out there. David knows this. David knows them. I'm sure a lot of them. But there are people who want to be able to help. They just don't know how to help. And in my case, my doctor, I gave him the where to go, who to contact, and he contacted the team at UM, Sylvester Comprehensive Cancer Centers. And now he is well versed in the cancer initiative. We need to do that same thing for the behavioral health initiative. And we have to be able to offer those, our brothers and sisters, a little guidance of how to find that good person for you. And not if you have somebody that you like, but they're not tuned into the fire. Educate them. Let them sit, lie on the couch one session and you sit in the chair and you tell them how important behavioral health initiative is in the fire service today, and especially and in all three branches. I mean, we're all, you know, it. And sadly, we're seeing almost as many suicides by hand in all three branches of public safety in today's, you know, we're almost a quarter of the way done with this millennium already. And, you know, it's, where do we go from here? And I think that we, not only do we, many of us have the problem, but we have the other problem is we know our problems, but we don't know if this person I'm talking to can actually help me. Does he know who I am as a firefighter? Does he know what I see as a police officer? Does she know what I do as a paramedic? If they don't, put on your teacher's hat. Guide them. My doctor, every time I see him now, every 6 months, he says, what's the latest? Anything new you got to tell me or I got to look up? I said, doc, there's always something new. You always just got to tune into the team. But you're a part of them now, you know? And don't be afraid. My words to you is don't be afraid to ask your therapist or your counselor for help. And if about specifically who you are and what you see in your job. And if they don't know about it, educate them. You have nothing to lose. Actually, you have a lot to gain by educating them, just like I did with my doctor. So, you know, even when you talk with David, if you reach out to him through his email or what else, he'll guide you on how to educate and give you some ideas that you can share with your counselor or therapist to help you and then help them help other yous, because you won't be the only one. Because once you're able to talk about it, and by the way, part of the most important process you can do, David, I hope you'll agree with me, is that you admit that you have the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Is the first step.
Yeah. It takes a lot of strength. It takes a lot of courage. We don't do vulnerability very well. We don't do shame. If you're a fan of Brené Brown's research into shame and vulnerability, she has a tremendous amount of teachings there. We have to be willing to step forward, though. Nobody can help you unless you are willing to receive that help.
Right. Right. And you can even teach your teacher. That's what I learned, is that there are doctors and nurses and case managers, et cetera, who want to help. They just need to know that your door is open to receive it. That's the key. And then you can educate them. So now you're doing a double goody, because you're getting some help for yourself and more pointed help because of your background as a firefighter or police officer or an EMS worker. And at the same time, you get to share your knowledge, what you've already gained, with them so they can learn more and help you and other members of the public safety teams to get better. Because once they know what they're, you know, you're not the harried businessman who have all these deadlines you have to make and huge conglomerate organizations you have to foster and work it into your business model. No, you just tell them what you do every morning when you walk into the barn, whether it's 8 a.m. or 8 p.m. or whatever your shift is, whether it's 8, 12, 24s, 48, 72s. Doesn't make any difference. You can tell them what we do, what you see, what bothers you, and let them learn from that. Because you can't just assume that every therapist you call up from Googling on your computer is going to know anything whatsoever about the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative. And if they don't, but you like them, help them learn. And that can carry you. Yeah. And that could help you reach wonderful conclusions with your care.
And while it's helping you, it's also allowing that therapist to better care for those future patients.
Exactly.
And developing that cultural competency. While we were talking, I actually had to pull up the statistics because I just misquoted myself and kind of disheartened to see this. So in 2021, according to the American Federation of Suicide Prevention, 48,183 Americans died by suicide. So I said that there's about a 25 to 1 completion ratio, but obviously that math is horribly awry because in 2021 there was an estimated 1.7 million suicide attempts.
Oh
So
my
that's
God.
more like a 35 to 1 attempt to completion ratio. Now, that was also the height of COVID. I'm sure that had something to do with it. We can't take people, we're human beings, we don't do social isolation well. We don't do the Van Orden's interpersonal theory of suicide has thwarted belongingness, hopelessness, and capacity for suicide, and then ultimately the attempt in the middle. If you look at the overlapping Venn diagrams, so when we take away that belongingness aspect of it, whether due to a pandemic or I'm going to editorialize for a second, even worse, if you're in the firehouse and you don't like somebody and you decide that you're going to shun them or you're just going to isolate them, it's probably one of the worst things we could ever do to human beings.
Yep.
And we're not always sure of what's going on in somebody else's personal life. Maybe they're going through a divorce, maybe they have a sick kid, maybe they're having financial troubles. Regardless of us having that knowledge, intentionally being mean, intentionally isolating people is not going to do anything for their mental health in a positive aspect. So it's something that we probably need to be a little bit better at. Now, I get it. There's the whole, we don't call it hazing anymore. It's the joking, it's the camaraderie, but sometimes it's not so funny. And when people have existing underlying issues, we really need to be more cognizant of how we're addressing them. In other words, be a good human. I think that's really what life summarizes to, is just if we're good human beings to one another and we take the time to have those one-on-one conversations and we make more deposits in that relationship than we do withdrawals, if you want to make it more of a financial decision, the more time I spend talking to you and getting to know you and truly caring about you, not just surface level, like, oh, hey, how's it going? A shift change. Tell me what's up with the truck. It's how's your family? How are your kids? Tell me about that vacation, that cruise that you were just talking about. I can spend time, 5, 10 minutes with a person and build that relationship. So on the days where maybe I'm having a bad day and I have to snap at them, they're not looking at it going, well, Wick's a jerk because he snapped at me. It's he's having a bad day. But more importantly, they can go, hey, he's already spent all this time asking about me. I can go to him when I have a problem. And we need more of that because if we can make those deposits, we have that building relationship, we foster that active, constructive responding to people. It builds and it bolsters that camaraderie because that's a hard conversation to have. It's an incredibly difficult conversation. It's something that, as a fire officer, you have to be ready to have. As a chief officer, you have to execute it perfectly. Even as a line firefighter, paramedic, EMT, police officer, you're going to have that conversation with somebody at some point in time. So now's the time to think about it. Now's the time to rehearse it. Now's the time to practice it as a simulation because you can't get it wrong when you have that conversation in real life.
Well said. Unfortunately, in today's world, we have a lot of pretenders. We've seen that on social media, especially in the fire service, or I don't know, going all the way back to maybe 2014, 50. You have these drones that hide in the basement. They're not firefighters. But they think they can comment on every firefighter post and tell them how to do it better. And
Oh,
then you
sure.
start finding out they don't know some of the right terms of firefighting that we use. And all of a sudden you say, wait a second, how could they say that? That's not what we use. We always refer to this like this way. But I don't know if they're really firefighters. And then you start to be able to weed them out. And I've seen that diminish over the last few years along that side, but there are still the I call them the basement dwellers. They don't want to come out into the light because their little world in the basement is their whole world. They don't have anything else beside that, other than the kitchen upstairs. That's it. That's their, they don't go out of the house. They don't work. They just loafing around. But they have their opinions that they can about us and the jobs we do on social media. All I can tell you is at first it really bothered the hell out of me. And then I grew up again. And I said, this is BS. This is not a firefighter. This is just crap being thrown out. Maybe he didn't make the exam. Maybe he went out. They wanted to do it. He didn't make the exam. So now every firefighter is his enemy or her enemy. It shouldn't be that way. But we as a group, firefighters, police officers, EMS personnel, we're not going to change them. But when we ignore them, that's even better than an exchange with them. Because when you learn to ignore them, and you learn to live by what's important to you and not let some ghost in a basement tell you what a real firefighter does, you're going to be better off for it. Because you know what? All have self-confidence, or you wouldn't be in this field, any of those three, if you didn't have self-confidence. Because you know any of those three are very, very difficult jobs. That's it. They're very, very difficult. And you're committed to doing that job anyway. You want to surmount the difficulties and be a shining light for that organization. And I couldn't, if that's your case, I couldn't admire you more.
Also, we weren't there. So how do we comment on something that we weren't involved in? And this, you know, you have Instagram and you have all these feeds where you're given a snippet of video. What happened 5 seconds prior, what happened 5 seconds afterwards? We don't even have a complete picture. So to opine in about, you know, they should have done, or, you know, I would have done, we can't figure that out. Right. We don't have that information. We don't know their training, their tactics, their staffing, what the situation was, were there delays? And realistically, why are we sitting here tearing each other down? We should be learning from one another. The agency that I work for versus some like FDNY, we can't do things the way that FDNY does them. They send, you know, 130 guys to a fire. On a great day, I'm sending 25. So there's no way for me to say, well, their tactics include 2 2.5s with 6 personnel on each. Like, that's phenomenal, and I would love to have that, but I don't. In the same vein, where I live is a very rural volunteer fire department. They getting 25 out to a fire is probably unheard of. So they can't do things the same way that we do things at work. So I can't judge people based off of a snapshot in time,
right,
that I wasn't there about. So when you just go, agreed, just go, hey, you know what? We're going to agree to disagree. I wasn't there. I really can't comment on it. You're not feeding into their psyche at that point, because they're right, looking to promote argument and see themselves as an expert. And reality, listen, I am way too busy in life to be arguing with people on the internet. It just doesn't work.
Right. What would you think, as we head towards the close of this interview, what would you think is the best way for a firefighter, we'll keep it to our branch, a firefighter who feels like they need to reach out to somebody, to find somebody to reach out to outside the department?
So for full-on clinical help or peer support, where are we going?
Not peer support, probably clinical help, you know.
So my colleague Angie runs the Center for Firefighter Behavioral Health out of the Medical University of South Carolina. They have an ever-expanding list of vetted clinicians. I know the National Volunteer Fire Council has a behavioral health directory that has individuals in there. I'm not going to say that they're not all vetted. I'm not that familiar with their process. So you would have to at least do your own research. Be an educated consumer of information is what I tell everyone.
Right. Now,
do your own research as to who it is. If you can't find anybody in one of those, send me an email. I'll try and help you find somebody. Again, I don't know what area everybody comes from, and it's going to be difficult. I know I've done it for the foundation before. We try and vet clinicians for them remotely if there's an incident, because while we can send our people out there. We can't embed them forever. And it's easier to be able to have a warm handoff to somebody who is local, and we can make that introduction and we can bring them into the fold, which would allow that name-to-face recognition. And it's hard because we also don't know, most people don't know the differences in therapies and the differences between psychologists and psychiatrists and licensed clinical social workers and mental health clinicians. They all have very specific terminology for a reason because they have very specific educations. And then when you start getting into cognitive behavioral therapy versus dialectic behavioral therapy versus EMDR, most people just heard me rattle off a bunch of acronyms, and right now they're staring at the screen going, "What is this guy talking about?" And that's part of the behavioral health mission, is to educate individuals on that. So when they go to look for that counselor, they can get a better handle on, I am looking for a therapist, whether a psychologist or a master's level, that could do EMDR and is trauma informed and could help me with this. So you could find the right person, or at least start on the right path, as opposed to just finding a therapist who may not have had any experience with the fire service and specifically the stuff that we need. We're seeing more and more people that are starting to become diagnosed with CPTSD, or complex post-traumatic stress. It was originally geared for child soldiers and victims of sex trafficking, but the amount of trauma that we experience in public safety meets the clinical criteria for it. And the other thing that, again, I'm going to editorialize for a moment, the thing that we need to change to reduce some of the stigma attached to mental health is, let's stop calling post-traumatic stress a disorder. I get it. It's in DSM. It's in our Bible for psychology. It's not a disorder, it's an injury. The hippocampus, if I were to scan the brain of an individual who has post-traumatic stress, their hippocampus has actually changed in structure as a result of this injury. No different than if I blow out my shoulder or blow out my knee. It's an injury. So if we talk post-traumatic stress injury versus the negative structure of post-traumatic stress disorder, because we hear disorder, and what comes to mind is the person who's on the street corner wearing, 14 layers of clothing, having an argument with themselves that seems inappropriate behavior for the environment. That's what we all envision. And nobody wants to be thought of as, quote, crazy.
Right.
They want the help, they need the help. But they also don't need the stigma and the shame attached to it.
Very well said. Very well said. David, our time is up, unfortunately, but I can't thank you enough. You far exceeded even what I was hoping and looking for.
It
And
was fun.
yeah, but I use fun for this one. I think it was important that we talk it out. A lot of the other, and I promote other firefighting podcasts as well. And somebody said, "Well, why would you do that? Don't you want to all listen to yours?" No. I said, "There are dozens of good firefighting podcasts out there, and they all find their own niche." I said, "I'm happy to promote them because I'm not the only guy in the market. And I'm certainly, being out since 1985, I'm certainly not all that well tuned in as some of the other podcasters are. So I'm fine with that." But it really, this, you gave me what I was looking for this podcast, for our
Excellent.
viewers and our listeners. Very, very important information. And the giving them that slap on the back that, hey, you know what? Yeah, we all got some of these issues. Doesn't mean we're crazy, doesn't mean we're nuts, doesn't mean we don't belong in the firehouse anymore. It just means we're human. And all we have to do is say, "I want to do something about that." And then you start your journey, finding
Absolutely.
that path to help you. And that's what we wanted, that's what I wanted to get out today. And that's what you really gave beautifully today. So I thank you so much. I know you're in a crazy schedule, but thanks for taking the time to join us today. It
Thank you for
was well worth it from my side, and I hope on yours as well. And to get this, be able to get this message out to so many other people is just can't always do that. And I'm so happy we were able to do it today. So
As
thank
am I.
you. All right, folks, if you're watching the video, this is going to be the end of this episode. If you're listening to the audio, Well, you know that we'll take a break. There'll be a couple more PSAs, then we'll be back with a couple of small segments. And we'll be back. Next week, we will be back, if all goes well, with William Cohut, APF Drones. We had to reschedule a couple of his appearances. We had a great interview a week ago, and unfortunately, Zoom did not live up to its best, and we lost half the show, audio and video. So David, William's going to bring us back, join us again next Tuesday, and we'll be able to bring you that information about drone use in emergency services. That'll be next week. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. We appreciate that you joined us once again. Remember, you can help us at our website, the www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. And just scroll down to you see the picture of the beautiful Q2B siren. Click on that, and our donation page will pop up. And while you're filling it out, and it says, where do you want the money going to? Your choices are either operations or foundation. Please put it to the foundation. Every penny that comes out of the foundation is for helping our brothers and sisters and or their families in dire need. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for your help. We'll see you next week once again on 5 Alum Task Force Corp. Stay safe, stay well. Let's remember to take care of each other. And let's make sure all of us go home. Bye-bye now.
You show up for your shift, but you're not feeling 100%. You greet your colleagues with a smile, but just can't put your finger on it. I'll shake it off in an hour, you think to yourself. You take a couple of nothing runs, but you're still not feeling any better when you get back to the barn. You throw some cold water on your face and think, yeah, that's more like it, and you head back to the day room. With training scheduled for after lunch, you make yourself comfortable in one of the recliners, but as you sit there, you feel ill. You start to sweat, and you feel nauseous. There's a pain in your left arm that you've never had before. Hey, guys, you call out. I'm not feeling well. And your voice trails, your eyes close, and the darkness surrounds you. More firefighters die from cardiovascular health issues than any other reason. Don't let self-pride get in the way of taking care of yourself. See your doctor on a regular basis, and be sure to advise him or her that you're a firefighter. Don't be a statistic. Be a healthy firefighter with a long career. For more information, visit the IAFF, NVFC, or IAFCSHS websites.
145 over 92.
180 over 111.
I had a heart attack and a cardiac arrest and then a stroke.
Your blood pressure numbers could change your life. Lowering your high blood pressure could save you from a heart attack or stroke. If you've stopped your treatment plan, restart it, or talk to your doctor about creating one that works better for you, start taking the right steps at manageyourbp.org.
Now I'm, trying to get better, stronger than ever.
Brought to you by the American Heart Association, American Medical Association, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Steve. It was a great interview with Captain David Wiklansky in the earlier part of the show. And David has been a great champion for the fire service, especially in his own home state of New Jersey, as our rep to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. Now, unless, heaven forbid, you've had to deal with the loss of a firefighter in your family, in your firehouse family, distant relative, whatever, we know that's a messed up time. And we also know that people are looking to us. The people we protect in our communities are looking to us to let them know life is good. It's okay. Yes, these things happen, but it doesn't turn the balance of life upside down. And our late, great teacher, mentor, leader, Chief Bruno, Alan Brunicini, taught us that the underlying most important factor we have as firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, and even law enforcement is to be nice to the people we care for. Be nice to somebody else that's not in your family. How many of you can say that you actually do that? You always try to be polite. You always try to be content. Try to be compassionate. You place yourself in your respondent or victim's life. And you'll understand how difficult it is to reach out. The first reach out probably came, massive reach out, was probably in the, just getting into the second decade of this millennia. And what's important to realize is that what Chief Bruno taught us, we should not need training on. It should be a natural part of who we are. And we have to remember also that right around this time, we started thinking about what's burning when we respond on calls today. Trash in a dumpster. Who would know that when trash in a dumpster burns, it can produce hydrogen sulfide gas? A very, very deadly way to die or be severely injured. And then we started realizing that that stuff there, that furniture, was real wood. It wasn't a benzene byproduct of a make-believe plastic. That was real wood on our desks, on our dining room tables. Real wooden legs on chairs. Even fancy chairs. And then we realized that something else was being reported all too frequently from these fires, and that was some form of cancer. So, we persevered for a couple of years, and then we realized what a difficult situation many of our departments, career, volunteer, part pay, WUI, have to deal with the traumas that we see, overtime, maybe double shifts, triple shifts. You don't get to see your family. You don't get to see your kids unless maybe your spouse brings them to the firehouse to visit you for a few minutes, but doesn't seem enough. And so as firefighters, trying to put on that good, strong face to calm the people we protect, is that we sacrifice ourselves physically and mentally. And with that said, in late 2017, early 2018, the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative was launched as well. And with that came some very, very brave firefighters. No, not because they rappelled off a large bridge tower to make a rescue. Not because they hung over a broken part of the freeway on a bridge that a truck had partially gone over the edge with, going through the barrier guards, and the truck halfway hanging loosely from the roadway. No. We were dealing with the demons that we face almost every day. Well, I don't have any demons. I love this job. I'm cool with it, man. It's good. That's BS. And maybe one day you'll actually fall for it. But if you're a good firefighter, a smart firefighter, always willing to learn to be the best firefighter you can be. You don't want to take a back seat. You want to jump in. And maybe you realize that you've had some emotional issues. Maybe somebody in the family was lost or very, very sick. Maybe, very likely, a brother or sister in the firehouse is not feeling all that great or is sick. And so, in today's episode, Dave Wuchlansky talked to us about the various programs that are out there. And the cost of most of these programs is absorbed by the NFFF so that they don't burden our frontline people with long, drawn-out classes that are just mutterings. There's no passion in the teacher's voice or in their head. They seem wan, they seem drawn, they seem tired out of their mind. But we have to give them some slack also, because they go around sometimes for a week at a time, or as David said in his interview, he'd be on duty for a day and a half, then they have to drive to his next speaking spot, go there, stay there two nights, and he has to run back. Doesn't even get back to the house. He has to go run back in time to get back to the hotel room and carry on the next day. All we ask is take care of yourself like you would take care of anybody who lives in your fire district or EMS district. They mean just as much as those close to us, because we took that oath to protect the property and lives of the people in our district. So, if you're a firefighter listening to this podcast, in this editorial, thank you for staying tuned. And if you need any help, you need to find someone to help you, you can reach out to me at dalmatprod@outlook.com, or you can reach out directly to Dave Wuchlansky. Even if you're not living in New Jersey, he'll still help guide you. And all that information is on the show notes. So, let's live by the Firefighter Cancer Initiative and the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative. Together, we are stronger, and a group is stronger than stragglers. Let's make ourselves into groups that care about our fellow brothers and sisters and how we can help them, even if it's just to point them in the right direction. That could be a massive help to them where they thought they had no help available to them. And that's my view. Hi, this is Steve. It was a great interview with Captain David Wuchlansky in the earlier part of the show. And David has been a great champion for the fire service, especially in his own home state of New Jersey, as our rep to the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation. Now, unless, heaven forbid, you've had to deal with the loss of a firefighter in your family, in your firehouse family, distant relative, whatever, we know that's a messed up time. And we also know that people are looking to us. The people we protect in our communities are looking to us to let them know life is good. It's okay. Yes, these things happen, but it doesn't turn the balance of life upside down. And our late, great teacher, mentor, leader, Chief Bruno, Alan Brunicini, taught us that the underlying most important factor we have as firefighters, EMTs, paramedics, and even law enforcement is to be nice to the people we care for. Be nice to somebody else that's not in your family. How many of you can say that you actually do that? You always try to be polite. You always try to be content. Try to be compassionate. You place yourself in your respondent or victim's life. And you'll understand how difficult it is to reach out. The first reach out probably came, massive reach out, was probably in the, just getting into the second decade of this millennia. And what's important to realize is that what Chief Bruno taught us, we should not need training on. It should be a natural part of who we are. And we have to remember also that right around this time, we started thinking about what's burning when we respond on calls today. Trash in a dumpster. Who would know that when trash in a dumpster burns, it can produce hydrogen sulfide gas. A very, very deadly way to die or be severely injured. And then we start realizing that that stuff there, that furniture, was real wood. It wasn't a benzene byproduct of a make-believe plastic. That was real wood on our desks, on our dining room tables, real wooden legs on chairs, even fancy chairs. And then we realized that something else was being reported all too frequently from these fires, and that was some form of cancer. So, we persevered for a couple of years, and then we realized what a difficult situation many of our departments, career, volunteer, part pay, WUI, have to deal with the traumas that we see, overtime, maybe double shifts, triple shifts. You don't get to see your family. You don't get to see your kids unless maybe your spouse brings them to the firehouse to visit you for a few minutes. But it doesn't seem enough. And so, as firefighters, trying to put on that good, strong face to calm the people we protect, is that we sacrifice ourselves physically and mentally. And with that said, in late 2017, early 2018, the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative was launched as well. And with that came some very, very brave firefighters. No, not because they rappelled off a large bridge tower to make a rescue. Not because they hung over a broken part of the freeway on a bridge that a truck had partially gone over the edge with, going through the barrier guards, and the truck halfway hanging loosely from the roadway. No, we were dealing with the demons that we face almost every day. Well, I don't have any demons. I love this job. I'm cool with it, man. It's good. That's BS. And maybe one day you'll actually fall for it. But if you're a good firefighter, a smart firefighter, always willing to learn to be the best firefighter you can be, you don't want to take a back seat. You want to jump in. And maybe you realize that you've had some emotional issues. Maybe somebody in the family was lost or very, very sick. Maybe, very likely, a brother or sister in the firehouse is not feeling all that great or is sick. And so, in today's episode, Dave Wiklansky talked to us about the various programs that are out there. And the cost of most of these programs is absorbed by the NFFF so that they don't burden our frontline people with long, drawn-out classes that are just mutterings. There's no passion in the teacher's voice or in their head. They seem wan. They seem drawn. They seem tired out of their mind. But we have to give them some slack also, because they go around sometimes for a week at a time, or, as David said in his interview, he'd be on duty for a day and a half, then he'd have to drive to his next speaking spot, go there, stay there two nights, and he has to run back. Doesn't even get back to the house. He has to go run back in time to get back to the hotel room and carry on the next day. All we ask is take care of yourself like you would take care of anybody who lives in your fire district or EMS district. They mean just as much as those close to us, because we took that oath to protect the property and lives of the people in our district. So, if you're a firefighter listening to this podcast, in this editorial, thank you for staying tuned. And if you need any help, you need to find someone to help you, you can reach out to me at dalmatprod@outlook.com. Or you can reach out directly to Dave Wiklansky. Even if you're not living in New Jersey, he'll still help guide you. And all that information is on the show notes. So let's live by the Firefighter Cancer Initiative and the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative. Together, we are stronger, and a group is stronger than stragglers. Let's make ourselves into groups that care about our fellow brothers and sisters and how we can help them, even if it's just to point them in the right direction. That could be a massive help to them where they thought they had no help available to them. And that's my view.
We are really glad to have you listening to 5 Alarm Task Force. But we also want you to know that there are some other terrific fire service podcasts available. Here's the short list. Beneath the Helmet with Chief Arjuna George. Students of the Game with Danny Beauvais. B-Shifter with Chief John Vance, Josh Bloom, and Nick Brunicini. The Professional Brotherhood with Chief Brian Soller. The Five-Tool Firefighter with Nick Higgins of the Firehouse Tribune. Station Talk with Assistant Chief Tom Marciano. Flow and Vent. DTFF, Down to Fight Fire, British Columbia Volunteers. Better Every Shift with Aaron Zamzo. Firefighter Success with Captain Jim Moss. Code 3, the Firefighters Podcast. Make Do with Nick Peppard and Sean Duffy. Getting Salty. Fit to Fight Fire. Remember, to be a great firefighter, you must be always willing to learn. This message is brought to you by 5 Alarm Task Force Corp. One mission, one family. First responders helping each other.
Every year, over 1 million fires burn in America. Fortunately, firefighters are on the job, saving life and property, and you can be a part of it. 7 out of 10 firefighters and emergency responders are volunteers. There's no typical firefighter. Anyone can volunteer to serve their community. Volunteering as a first responder is really about having the heart and drive to make a difference where it's needed most. Your community needs you. Are you ready to answer the call? Learn more and find local volunteer opportunities at makemeafirefighter.org.
And that wraps this episode of 5 Alarm Task Force, brought to you by 5 Alarm Task Force Corp. One family, one mission, first responders helping each other. We'd like to thank our guest, Captain David Wicklansky, for joining us to discuss the Firefighter Behavioral Health Initiative and his work with new programs, the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation. Did you know you can find us and subscribe to us on all the top podcast platforms? Just search for 5 Alarm Task Force. We also want to thank our sponsors, Insight Training LLC, the Firehouse Tribune, and LifeScan Wellness Centers, as well as our promotional partners, Chief Miller Products and Sites, Thin Red Line, Decon, Hass Alert, Pry Guy Levers and Nestabars, Silver Arrow Coaching and Consulting, Crackle Magazine, the EFT Corporation, Health KPI, the Firefighter Cancer Foundation, the Firefighter Cancer Support Network, the Albemarle Sweet Shop, North Florida Fire Expo, and the Great Florida Fire School. If you would like to be a guest with us or have a suggestion for a show, please drop us a line to info@5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. You can follow us on Twitter or X and Instagram at 5 Alarm Task Force, on Facebook at facebook.com/5, then all in caps, A Apple, T Tango, F Foxtrot, C Charlie. And on YouTube, please subscribe to our channel, 5-Alarm Task Force Corp. Stay up to date with all the news about our podcast, our nonprofit foundation, and our blog on our website, www.5-alarmtaskforcecorp.org. I'm Steve Green. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and let's make sure everyone goes home.